Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
When I was 11, I became fat. Then my mother went crazy. She said, my son is ugly, he's fat. What am I going to do with him? And she thought, where is the worst food in the world? And she thought, English food. And she sent me to this English school, in a boarding English school. There was a theater at school. And at age 13, they gave me my first part. If I had stayed fat, if I had not learned English, if I had not had a theater at school, I would be a timber merchant like my father.
Omar Sharif, the star of Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, and many other films, died today. He was 83 years old. We'll talk about his career later in the show. But first, it seems like every media outlet these days is saying something like this.
Years of borrowing, a dwindling tax base, billions in debt. We now know what rock bottom looks like.
No, that is not Greece, but Detroit.
Detroit is officially the largest city in history to file for bankruptcy. This morning, emergency manager Kevin Orr announced the Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy filing.
That was 2 years ago this week, and since then, Kevin Orr successfully navigated Detroit through the largest and most complicated city bailout in American history. Well, we wondered what the similarities might be between Greece and Detroit, and what Greece and the EU could possibly learn from the Detroit bankruptcy, and Kevin Orr joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Well, usually, you know, when a country has crippling debt, there is a clear path of things to do. Print more money, make things cheaper, encourage, you know, private investment and commerce. But Greece can't really do all of that because it's part of the EU. It certainly can't print its own money. So does that make it, in effect, more like Detroit, like a city?
You know, there are similarities, but there are also differences. I mean, you're right. Usually a country would try to devalue its currency and therefore increase inflows and make its products cheaper so it can sort of grow its way out of its debt. Greece, as a member of the EU, doesn't have that ability because it's bound by the euro. So, but there are similarities in terms of it has too much debt. It apparently at this point does not have the revenue to service that debt, and it does need to restructure. Of course, there are open questions about how the country, and we'll see that as we get more details about the plan presented by the Prime Minister, how the country can sort of assist itself, for instance, with tax collection and with shadow economy collection. Almost 24% is estimated that almost 24% of Greece's GDP is off the books. It's in the shadow economy, black market. You know, what it can do address those concerns. There's reports that $80 billion is offshore, perhaps in foreign banks in Switzerland and other places, of money that would otherwise be tax revenue for the country. You know, what is it going to do to address that? Is tax compliance for the citizens, the covenant that we have between citizens and an enterprise, is that they pay for services. The municipality, or in this case the country, provides those services, and citizens pay for their government. There's some estimates that say that their current tax collection rate is below 75%. So what can it do to increase that? So there's some self-help measures, which we had to go through in Detroit as well. But one thing they do not have is the framework of a bilateral situation that allowed us through a state statute, 436, and then the federal statute, Chapter 9. That they do not have.
Right, right. Well, you know, and in the situation of the United States, and I think Texas went through a similar thing during the S&L crisis, is that the United States government said, okay, we'll just bail you out.
Right.
You know, you don't have to go through an austerity program, Texas. Maybe Detroit had to. It had to deal with its pension obligations and come up with some better tax compliance figures, as you put it.
Yes.
So in that sense, is it a little bit more like Greece's situation?
I think the thing that you know, we have to consider with Greece is the Greek people are a proud people, and they gave us democracy and the rule of law and the consent to govern and all those concepts. And I think the referendum on Sunday was sort of a testament to that. But at the end of the day, you know, they owed over $330 billion on July 4th. And after the referendum on Monday, July 6th, they'd owed over $350 billion. So we have to deal with the facts. And the self-help component of this, which I think is what some of the creditor nations, you know, France and in particular Germany are saying is, let's explore some of those options first before we start talking about a quote-unquote bailout. Because I think we have to remember that because they're in the EC, the euro, if Greece were to ultimately default and move out of the European community, you know, these countries may end up acting like a surety for some of that debt. So it's in everybody's interest for Greece to see what it can do on its own. In Detroit, we did increase our tax collection rates. We tried to right-size the budget on the way out so we could pay as we go, live within the means. We set out 10 years of projections. We increased good financial reporting so our creditors and our counterparties would get a true view of the state of affairs in the city. And we tried to provide a basis for citizens to feel that those services were going to be improved so we could meet the obligations we had on the covenant. It's been 6 months, which is early, but the indications are that we're meeting those targets, if not exceeding them. So this stuff can turn fairly quickly if you get your own financial house in order and try to restructure as best you can.
But how painful was it to do that, to get
it wasn't easy.
There
were clearly some people who were not happy. And you know, but part of it, Madeline, the reason I said the Greek people are proud is part of it is getting the news out of the true state of financial affairs. There was some concern expressed in 2012 about the ability of the government to report accurately, getting the true state out. If you do that, you know, my experience has been people are remarkably logical. In our case, for instance, our pensioners, 83% of them voted for an adjustment to their pensions, self-help. They did it themselves. So but we have to remain humane as well. I mean, you know, a pensioner that retired at 55 in Greece is now being told at 72 that he's in a crisis. What is that person supposed to do at that point in their life?
Yeah. And adding on top of that, Greece is now dealing with a refugee crisis from Syria. That is extraordinary, right? It's got, you know, 1,000 people a day coming.
The island of Lesbos has more people on it. I heard a figure that said in the past 3 months, there are more refugees than in all of 2014. So that spurs, you know, we those of us that are watching this need to think of this in sort of a layered way. I mean, tier one, phase one, of course, is the debt. You borrowed money, you should pay it back. By the same token, you have to right-size the debt and figure out a way to do that. Phase two is to make sure that you avoid civil unrest. And that was a huge concern of ours in Detroit. And I'm proud to say that the good people of Detroit did not engage in that conduct, as we've seen in some other situations lately. Phase three is the risk always of adventurism by some third parties. You know, last summer, there was a lot of mischief over in the Bosphorus and the Black Sea by various other countries. Mm-hmm. And I think those of us in the West need to be sensitive that not just on a refugee side, but also on an opportunistic side by some other countries, that we don't want that dog to get off the porch. You want to keep that dog on a chain.
Right. So given all that, what you just said, do you think that the Troika, the Europeans, do you think that they are acting too harshly with Greece and that they should forgive some of the debt? And
You know, it's hard to be judgmental. I mean, we've seen the French on the one side act as sort of an intercessionary, which was productive. We've seen the Germans, which are entirely understandable, that they're responsive to their citizens. They're productive. They're a creditor nation. They lent the money. They want to get paid back. I mean, if you lend your cousin $100, you want to see him pay you back. So there seems to be a good bit of dialogue that has evolved. Prime Minister Tsipras has punched out a report. We haven't seen the details, but has made a proposal. So at least there's progress. There's structure, and there's progress, and that's a good thing. The devil will be in the details. Whether or not they're too harsh, I mean, there is the concern that if you borrow this magnitude of money, you need to find a way to work your way through it. By the same token, the concerns I just expressed and also the humanitarian concern that, you know, none of us would be happy in America if you went to your ATM and you were limited to $66. That wouldn't feel good.
Right. So I'm wondering, though, as you look at this and you look at it from a perspective of an American, but you're obviously very knowledgeable and well-steeped in what's happening there, if this, to you, raises questions about the solidarity of the EU and whether or not this is, in fact, one political body or not.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, in any new form, you know, you have a shakeout period and you have adjustments. I mean, we're the United States of America, and this is the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, 1865 to 2015, and we're just taking down the Confederate flag. So, you know, you're going to work through some things as you move forward. I think what we have to hope is that Prime Minister Tsipras and the new finance minister, Zakalatos, who I understand was educated at St. Paul's and Eton's and is very knowledgeable in economics and the Western way of thinking, are trying to use their good offices and good faith to address this concern. And as it shakes out, I think we should be very careful not to get prematurely judgmental about the future of the EU. 150 years later, we're still working to form a more perfect union.
Mm. Well, and so on that note, how is Detroit doing these days?
Detroit is at or exceeding our financial expectations. I understand that the development curve in the Central Business District is well above water, has a great deal of interest. It's doing quite well on the city center system, 9 square miles downtown, but it's 139 miles square. And the real challenge over time that Mayor Duggan and City Council President Jones are going to have to do is to try to push some of that economic development and growth out to the other 130 miles. But from the financial balance sheet standpoint, it's doing better than we had anticipated, and we're very thankful for that.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Kevin Orr, bankruptcy lawyer and partner at the firm Jones Day. He was emergency manager of Detroit from March 2013 to December 2014. Coming up on the show, a bunch of Hollywood Hills homeowners don't want tourists clogging their streets to get an up-close look at the Hollywood sign unless they want those tourists to rent out their homes on Airbnb. That's next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
They get out of their cars. The narrow, winding road is only big enough for two cars, and so now it becomes a road hazard. People also come here to take photographs. They get out of their cars, a lot of people getting out of their cars and tour buses. Then what they do is they cross the street, they stand in the middle of the street, and it becomes a hazard.
That's a local resident complaining about tourists who come to his neighborhood to look at the Hollywood sign. He spoke to the British newspaper The Telegraph a few years ago. Today, the fight over the iconic landmark is still going on. And in the latest twist, homeowners in the Hollywood Hills are suing the city to close all public access to the sign. But some of those very same homeowners are advertising their proximity to the sign in order to attract Airbnb renters. So can they have it both ways? Alyssa Walker is the urbanism editor at Gizmodo, and she discovered this contradiction, shall we say, this week. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, first let's talk about the lawsuit. These homeowners near the sign, they've sued. And what are they claiming in their lawsuit?
Well, their big claim in the lawsuit, among many things, and I should say that it's a kind of a rogue neighborhood association. There's several different neighborhood associations, and this is one that's kind of gone above and beyond the other complaints in the neighborhood and has decided to file this complaint. And the complaint is that the city has done too much to encourage tourism in the area. They've improved one of the viewpoints, which is near Lake Hollywood, which they claim they've actually made it better and encouraged tourists to go there. And then, of course, there's a trail that's opened at the end of Beechwood Canyon, which was closed for several months as a new gate was put in. The trail's been reopened, and now this flood of tourists and residents of Los Angeles are now coming into the area.
Do they want all access cut off or just the access that's near their homes?
I think it's not outlined this specifically, but I do believe that they would want not only the roads closed, but also the public trails in the public park closed.
But as you say, it's public, so...
Exactly. This is a public park. Access to the hiking trails are there for not only the people who are visiting the city, but also the people who live in the city. I want to be able to hike there as well.
All right, so let's talk about what you discovered. You went on Airbnb and you found out that some of these homeowners are actually advertising their proximity to the sign to attract people to rent their homes?
Yes, of course. And, you know, of course, if you're going to have a property on Airbnb, you want to do your best to include these beautiful images and great descriptions of the of your room to rent. And what I noticed, thanks to a video that was sent to me, is how many of these people are using the proximity to the Hollywood sign as a major marketing point in their Airbnb listing. So you'll see some of the listings say, you know, actually are named like Hollywood Sign Views is the name of the property with these great images of the sign right there. And it's just... it's just totally goes against everything that they're trying to fight against with the city, because it's saying that this is not a great place to see the sign. We don't want tourists to come here, but we do want tourists to come here if they're, you know, paying $395 a night to stay in this room.
And these are actually the same people who are filing the lawsuit?
Well, I don't know for sure who these people are. You know, they only have people's first names on Airbnb, or some people can use different names and different avatars. So it's not really a... it's hard to find the exact person. I guess you could go through and try to find out who these people actually are. I didn't feel the need to do that. But I just think there can't really be a double standard here about, yes, we want some tourists to come who are going to pay us money, but we don't want the tourists who are walking through our streets and climbing on these trails and just coming to take pictures. Those people are obviously not welcome.
Mm. But I could see their argument being one of scale. Like, you know, when you're renting out your house, it's only maybe a few people. But they're talking about tour buses and lots of people clogging up the streets and saying that it could be dangerous. You know, fire trucks and ambulances couldn't get through. So do they have a point?
I think there's two things going on here. The parking issue, which, you know, I'm a big proponent of public transit. I believe that we should have better public transit connections to the Hollywood sign. You can take the Dash bus up Beechwood Canyon and get pretty close, and which it actually makes a great hike. So I encourage a lot of people to do that. The parking issue is definitely an issue, but they've actually gone to the city already and gotten permitted parking for the area. So all these streets, you actually can't park there unless you're a resident on the weekend. And I believe that they're trying to extend that to be during the week as well. That I'm in total favor of. I agree that parking, you know, we shouldn't encourage more cars to be anywhere, because it's also a very beautiful natural area. And let's try to get some of the cars out of the way. But the other thing about restricting access is it's a public street. I have the right to walk down that street and look at the beautiful architecture of these beautiful homes that are advertised on Airbnb. I have the right to take photos of myself standing in the street with the Hollywood sign over my shoulder. So I think you can't have it both ways. You can't try to keep people out of some parts, keep people away from a park, but not on the street. It's just kind of a mess, and it has to either be everything or nothing.
So City Councilman Tom LaBunge, who was termed out, was a big proponent of granting the public access. And I think he's seen as the enemy by a lot of these homeowners. And the new City Councilman, David Rue, he campaigned on this issue as well. So what do you think he's going to do?
You know, I don't actually know what his stance is. I think he's been very smart to not comment on the issue with too much detail. He has talked about some other pedestrian issues in the city and come out in favor of pedestrian access, like the Hyperion Bridge, which is being redesigned for pedestrians and bikes. But he hasn't really said what he plans to do with the Beechwood Canyon situation. And so it'll be interesting to see how he comments on this lawsuit.
Alyssa Walker is the urbanism editor at Gizmodo. Thanks, Alyssa.
Thank you so much.
Okay, what do you think? What's the best solution to this issue? Should there be some restrictions, or are the homeowners near the Hollywood sign just being NIMBYs? Leave us a voicemail at 1-800-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. That's KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, our Friday film review segment. This week, the super blockbuster to the super indie, Minions and Tangerine, and later on, Tab Hunter, 50s screen idol turned gay icon.
I love you.
I love you too, my darling.
then let's make love, you sweet little thing.
Tab Hunter Confidential after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Is dead.
Yes. Why?
This is my well.
I have drunk from it.
You are welcome.
That's Omar Sharif making his entrance in Lawrence of Arabia. Omar Sharif died today in Cairo. He was 83 years old. He's one of the few Arab actors to ever rise to the top of Hollywood. In addition to Lawrence of Arabia, he also starred in Dr. Zhivago. And that's where we're going to start our film roundup this week. Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube, is here. Hi, Christy.
Hi, good to see you.
Nice to see you. And Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and vice president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Welcome back, Tim.
Hi there.
All right. So favorite Omar Sharif roles?
I mean, the clip, Lawrence of Arabia. I know as a young, aspiring, you know, film lover, Lawrence of Arabia left this indelible impression on me. I actually was very lucky. First time I ever saw it was at the Cinerama Dome here in Los Angeles. And to see his entrance as this little speck in the distance getting closer and closer and closer. I mean, what an amazing opening to a character. And Sharif had such grace and such grandeur to that character, that introduction set him up so perfectly. And like you were saying, you know, Madeline, I think as a young film viewer, he probably was the first Arab actor I ever saw on screen. And I mean, he's done so many roles since then, but that one will always stay with me, as I think it will for most film lovers.
And Dr. Zhivago as well, of course. But I think about the first time I ever saw Omar Sharif, and that was in Funny Girl.
With Barbara Streisand.
As a little girl, I remember it so well because he's so charming and sophisticated, but he also has to hold his own as the straight man opposite this force of nature in Barbara Streisand, and how just totally charming he was, and Nicky Arnstein, what a beautiful, beautiful name. And I think about that all the time when I think of Omar Sharif, but then he would have a little bit of fun in a movie like Top Secret. He does a poop joke in Top Secret. I mean, so he had a very wide career.
And he played so many different ethnicities, right? He played Russian. He played, you know, obviously Arab in Lawrence of Arabia. And he played Che Guevara as well.
And he spoke several languages. He was very versatile. He could do everything.
Yeah. Okay, let's clear the decks here because now we're going into something completely different. And that is Minions. This is going to be a huge blockbuster for maybe the rest of the summer, right? I mean, it's kind of a sequel to Despicable Me.
It's kind of a prequel. It's kind of an origin story because it's who the Minions are, where they came from, how they developed, and how their lifelong dream has always been to serve the biggest and most terrible master they can find.
Oh, I love England. The music, the fashion. I'm seriously thinking about overthrowing it someday. Anyway, this pale drink of water oversees it all. I'm her biggest fan, love her work, and I really, really, really want her crown.
Steal me the crown and all your dreams come true.
Respect. Power.
Banana.
Banana.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Did you like it, Tim?
It's fun up to a point. I mean, it's very much geared to young kids. And I saw it actually last night with a huge audience, mostly kids and their parents. I didn't take a survey afterwards, but the kids loved it. And the adults and myself, I think, get a little bored because they're adorable. The Minions are really, really fun. And they talk that combination of gibberish and French and Spanish and a little of English. Your kids will love it. I think the adults in the audience will wish It was a little funnier, a little more sophisticated.
Yeah, I can attest to all of that as the mother of a 5.5-year-old son who loves the Minion so much he thinks he is a Minion. And so he was pumped and he was like cackling.
Does that mean you're the evil genius?
I always have been, even before I was a mom. But no, it's, and I like the previous Despicable Me movies, but they need a central character who is strong like Gru, who has complexity like Gru. And yeah. The villain that they hook up with, who we heard voiced by Sandra Bullock, her name is Scarlet Overkill. There's not much to her, and she's very shrieky. So you have no real strong center because the Minions are scattered and insane and silly. So there's nothing really that's propelling it in a substantive way, which I realize is a totally film criticky thing to say about a Minion movie. I think the marketing for the Minion movie is better than the Minion movie itself.
The marketing is ubiquitous.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The Cinerama Dome is covered in Minions and a giant banana.
It took over the Los Angeles Times, the front page of the Los Angeles Times. So it's going up against Inside Out in terms of animated movies to see. Inside Out's been out for a few weeks, but it seems like they're kind of pretty much opposites, right?
I mean Inside Out is a much better film just in general, but I think from what I've actually heard, I'd be curious to hear what Christy thinks about this. I feel like kids maybe don't respond to Inside Out maybe as much as maybe say teenagers and adults because of the emotional nuance in that film. Mm-hmm. Where I think for people who want to take their little ones to an animated movie, Minion seems like the movie because it's really fun, it's really silly. There's a lot of like classic rock songs from the Rolling Stones and Donovan and the Beatles.
For the parents, obviously.
That's the only thing that I think will keep kind of parents. So the parents next to me seem very happy each time a Rolling Stones song
came on. A lot of money on music for this film. I would say that Inside Out really truly is more for adults. And kids respond to that on a very primal level. The colors, the liveliness. My son's favorite part of Inside Out is when anger sets fear's butt on fire. Just to give you an idea of how he responded to that. But the Minions he loved much, much more.
All right, let's move on to Stranger Land. This is Nicole Kidman and Joseph Fiennes in a tiny Australian town. Their kids disappear in a dust storm. Tension ensues.
I really think we should go to the police.
No, I'm not going to the police.
Well, I'm not just staying here. We could be out there in that.
I'm not going through it all again. Everyone knowing our business. We're just getting settled here.
Come on, Matthew, this is different. Tom is gone too.
All right, Tim, this sounds scary, a thriller. It's set in the outback. Did you like it?
Not very much, I have to say. And as a big Nicole Kidman fan, it made me even sadder to not like it. You know, it is an atmospheric character piece thriller. Joseph Fiennes and Nicole Kidman are this unhappy married couple. Their kids disappear one night. Where did the kids go? Hugo Weaving is this investigator who goes to try and find them. The movie is so fraught with importance from the single, like the first second of the movie. Everything means something. Every character is suffering from some kind of loss or some sort of sense of separation. Which could be good. It's a first-time filmmaker from Australia, Kim Ferrant. And there are good ideas. It's beautifully shot. The outback of Australia looks absolutely gorgeous. But every character is so self-serious that even though Nicole Kidman gives a very good performance, the movie takes itself so seriously, it's impossible for me as a viewer to take it as seriously.
Yeah, it's so overlong and such a drag, and there are so many red herrings, and they're trying to inject this like Aboriginal mysticism into it, and that doesn't ever really take shape, and kind of a bummer.
It seems like there's a little mini genre of these kind of lost in the outback movies, right?
I mean, there's
Picnic at Hanging Rock, for example, which comes
and kind of like Picnic at Hanging Rock. This movie is not about finding the people that are missing. It's more about what they represent, and I agree. Like that could be very interesting. Picnic at Hanging Rock is a great movie, but this movie, it's almost like if there were jokes, it would ruin the seriousness of their intention, which I think sometimes is the failing of a first-time filmmaker. They think that they have to be so dour all the time because their message is so valuable. Whereas if they lightened up a little bit, I think it would help so much for the movie.
But it's Nicole Kidman's first Australian indie since Dead Calm in 1989. And it's a great example of her willingness to go to dark and disturbing places for a character.
And she gets to speak in her native accent.
She does. So. Yeah. There's that. Her.
There is that.
So if that's a hook for
well,
people.
Well, that's enough for me. And one dingo ate my baby. Okay. So moving on, coming back to this side of the world, Tangerine, it's set in Los Angeles. It's about two transgender prostitutes on Christmas Eve. And here's a clip from the trailer.
Hey, Alexandra, come here. Listen, have you seen Cindy?
Cinderella. Looks like someone has a crush.
Cindy's back on the block?
Oh, yeah, she's back. She's back and she's going hard.
Merry Christmas, bitch. Woo!
Okay, so this movie has an interesting backstory. It was shot on an iPhone 5S, apparently.
Yes, and it's a great LA movie, and it has a great energy about it. And the fact that it was shot on this iPhone gives it this great intimacy and immediacy and just an energy to it. The two actresses playing Cindy and Alexandra, Kiki Rodriguez and Maya Taylor, are hilarious, have amazing chemistry. It's just a really great LA movie.
And yes, are they transgender, the actresses?
Yes, they are. And it is geographically accurate, which I hope our listeners appreciate, because I know when I'm watching a movie set in LA and they're on the wrong freeway, it really bothers me.
Or if they're in Toronto.
Right. Yeah. This is totally like they're on the right bus line. Like it things like that, I think, matter. And it has a great vibe to it.
Yeah. It's set mostly around Highland and Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. And it kind of extends around there. And it very much captures that part of Los Angeles really, really nicely. And I love that clip that we played, because I think it captures the idea. Because I think some people may have this idea that it's a very gimmicky movie. It's shot on an iPhone. It has transgender actors. Is there some sort of like big message this movie's trying to send? And the message is there is no message. It's a very funny, very kind of blunt and kind of rude. I mean, one of the things that I love about this movie is that both of the main characters are just kind of brassy, and they're kind of jerks in certain ways. And the movie just embraces it. These are not ennobled characters in any way. They're just real people.
And it's raunchy and hilarious, but the last shot, the last image you see is just really beautifully poignant and a nice counterpoint to everything we've just seen previously.
So yeah. It sounds like a new Christmas classic.
It's really cool. But it also gets how LA is hot and kind of steamy and, it's Christmas, but we have no snow.
And it's weird. And it's weird to be in Los Angeles on Christmas Eve, because there is no snow. Some of the characters actually talk about that. Yeah, it's of all the movies this weekend, it's the one to definitely, definitely see.
I agree.
Okay, well, a movie that opened last weekend that we didn't get to talk about because we were on tape last weekend was the holiday, was Magic Mike XXL. And here, let's play a clip.
I got a little treat for y'all tonight. It's a man I knew as White Chocolate. Some might know him as Magic Mike. We're going to see if he's still got some magic in that mic.
All right, Christy, I think I'm only going to talk to you about this.
I'm sorry.
Hey, that's not.
Is there somebody else here right now? I did not even know that. Now,
I'll slink away.
Please. This is just straight up fun, but it also is more substantive than the first Magic Mike. Steven Soderbergh did not direct this. He shot it and he cut it under his usual pseudonyms, and he's a producer on it, but it feels very much like a Steven Soderbergh film in the vibe of it. It's really, really fun, but it also is a road trip movie, and it takes its time at each stop. So the clip we just heard was Jada Pinkett Smith at this private members-only strip club that she built at this historic home in Savannah. And it's about how these dancers like find their voice, which sounds very Oprah, but like they find their purpose on this road trip and why they're dancing and who they are. And it takes.
Do we really care about the plot?
There's still crazy sexy dancing. I mean, like ridiculous finale with Channing Tatum and Twitch from So You Think You Can Dance.
Oh, yeah.
It's a gorgeously choreographed scene. It's sexy. See it in a packed theater full of girlfriends and gay men and just scream and hoot and holler. But it also is about something.
Tim, do you want to weigh in?
Can I say something? Yeah. as the straight man representation, I liked the first Magic Mike a little better. I thought it had a better story. But I agree that this one is very, very fun. The dancing is by the same choreographer, Allison Falk, who did the first movie. As Christy said, this one is much more of a straight up road trip slash movie musical in the way it's done. And the dance sequences are beginning to end great. They're really, really, really well done. It's really fun. I think one of the great things about this movie is it survives the absence of Matthew McConaughey, who I thought was like one of the best parts of the first movie. And even though he's not in this movie, it's still really entertaining. And I think it also just reminds people of just how charismatic, how much fun Channing Tatum is as an actor. In terms of like A-list stars, he's one of my absolute favorites right now. He's funny. He's charming. He's really sexy. And he hasn't lost a single dance step in the 3 years since he did the first Magic Mike.
And I appreciate, too, that they did not just replicate the first film. Like, yeah. Pitch Perfect 2 is straight up Pitch Perfect all over again. This dares to be different in some ways.
Okay, I see a double bill here. Magic Mike and Tangerine, right?
You'd
be perfect, yeah.
Okay, thanks, you guys. Tim Gerson, Senior U.S. Critic for Screen International, Vice President of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and Christy Lemire, Film Critic and co-host of What the Flick, which you can check out on YouTube. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now I know what you're going to see this weekend, Warren Olney.
Couldn't keep me away. We're going to talk today about facial recognition technology, which suggests that we might all lose our anonymity in public. And if, for example, you went to a strip club like that, it might come back to haunt you many, many years later because it turns up in a database and could be used in whatever way that anybody decided to use it. That's the technology that we're moving toward, and there are no regulations at all except in a couple of states, Illinois and Texas. But the industry has, Facebook and primarily Facebook, which has the biggest database of anybody with more than a billion names in it, they're resisting regulation of any kind, despite the fact that it's being argued by privacy advocates that you ought to at least be able to say no.
Right. So they're culling all this from your tagging, when you tag your friends and yourself. And
that's the concern, that will happen sooner or later.
Okay. Warren Olney?
And it will be made available to law enforcement, to various companies that use it in different ways. And it has some very interesting ramifications.
Okay. Masks for everyone. Warren Olney, To the Point, coming up at 1 o'clock. Thank you. And coming up on this program, how 50 Screen Idol Tab Hunter, maybe the Channing Tatum of his day, managed to keep his sexuality a secret. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. With his blonde hair and million-dollar smile, Tab Hunter was one of the biggest heartthrobs of the 1950s.
This young fellow you've been waiting for, ladies and gentlemen, Tab Hunter!
6 feet of rugged manhood to stir the heart of every woman.
Oh, my goodness, I'm flabbergasted!
Tab Hunter!
He was also gay, a secret that he and the studios kept for decades. Tab Hunter is in his 80s now, and he's retired, spending quality time with his longtime partner, Alan Glazer, and his horse, Harlow. And he's the subject of a new documentary called Tab Hunter Confidential that will screen at Outfest in L.A. tomorrow night. I'm joined in the studio by Jeffrey Schwarz. He's director of Tab Hunter Confidential. Hello.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you. And Tab Hunter himself, who is in KCRW Studios in Santa Barbara. I'm great. How are you?
Very well, thank you. But you got it wrong. The studio never talked about my sexuality. That was very interesting. In those days, those things were never discussed. Now, certain studios would comment on certain actors. I know Tony Perkins over at Paramount. Paramount talked to him and told him not to see me. But as far as I was very fortunate, Warner Brothers, no one ever said a word.
Well, the contracts for all the movie stars had a morality clause in it. And that could
mean
a lot of things. So Tab was an employee, essentially, of a studio.
And what's a morality clause?
Morality clause. Tab, you probably could answer this better.
Well, if you drink, you're out. If you do this, I mean, they protected their stars, and you had a code to follow that, and you just followed it. And if you didn't do what they asked, you were out, and they'd get another person to do the job. It was that simple.
So the movie starts with a scandal, a tabloid scandal. You're arrested at what the paper calls a limp-wristed party.
Well, that's BS. A limp-breasted party. I was like 17 or 18 years old. I went into a party, walked in, I saw some guys dancing, and I thought, oh, it's one of those kind of parties. I went to the refrigerator, and bingo, the cops walked in.
Well, we have to remember that homosexuality was illegal. It was against the law to be gay and for gay people to congregate together, even in a private home. So the LAPD, this was not an uncommon thing for the LAPD to hear about a party like this, even though it was completely innocuous, like Tab said, and just bust in and drag everybody off to the in the paddy wagon.
So this happened before you were a big movie star, but the scandal cropped up again later when you were a big movie star and the studio hushed it up. How did they do that?
The scandal popped up because Henry Wilson heard that Rock Hudson Confidential magazine was going to be doing a story on Rock. And since I left Henry and went to Dick Clayton,
and he was your agent?
He was my agent, uh-huh. Yes. But I left him to go with Dick Clayton, who became an agent, one of the top agents in Hollywood. Well, the minute I left Dick Clayton, Henry thought, whoa. And he turned that story over to Confidential magazine to protect a story they were going to be doing on Rock.
Isn't show business just wonderful?
That's why I spend my time at the barn shoveling the real stuff with my horses.
But they actually, you know, they created scenarios where you were seen in public with young starlets, women.
Well, they're trying to promote young starlets, of course, and they're promoting you, so you do what they ask you to do. I mean, if I want to go on a date with Natalie, I'd ask her out.
Natalie would.
If the magazines wanted to do a layout of Natalie and myself at the barn or at the beach or with whoever, you know, Dolores Hart or I don't care who, they would contact the studio and they would set the whole thing up.
There are the movie magazines, the fan magazines that worked with the studios to create the stars, put them on the cover, set up these dates, do photo layouts with Tab on the town with Debbie Reynolds and so forth. And then there was Confidential magazine, which was sort of the ugly stepchild of the movie magazines. This was
well,
like
you're being kind, Jeffrey.
Well, they were pretty sleazy. They were like the early. It was like the TMZ of the day, and it wasn't really taken seriously. People would maybe read them, you know, at the beauty parlor, and you know, but that magazine did publish a story about Tab, but you had to kind of read between the lines to really know what they were talking about. They did call it a limp-wristed pajama party, which actually sounds like a lot of fun to me. But, you know, when it came out, it actually didn't really – Tab, we talk about it in the film, Tab was pretty distraught that came out, and he thought it was the end of his career. But, in fact, nothing really happened.
But how afraid were you that if you were known as gay, that would be the end of your career?
Well, the word wasn't around in those days, and I never flaunted anything. It was nobody's business what I did. I mean, I did my job at the studio as best to the best of my abilities, and from there, my real touch of reality was being at the barn with my horses. That's my whole life. I was happiest there, being away from all the other stuff. The work was wonderful.
And you ask about Tab, quote unquote, coming out. I mean, this is decades before gay liberation. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it would be nobody would, in their right mind, would come out of the closet. The idea wasn't even in the culture. Even gay people, they led gay lives, and they could lead very happy lives, but it all had to be behind closed doors. It all had to be private.
Were you ever tempted, Tab, to get married as a cover?
Oh, twice. Not as a cover. Why do you say as a cover? If I wanted to get married, I'd get married because I really love someone. I mean, I think, you know, it just depends on the individual. Some people feel they have to do something, and other people feel that they react to what they really inwardly feel is right. I didn't feel it would be right at that time. But yes, I almost married a Chica Chereau, a French actress I worked with. And of course, Harry Cohn, the head of Columbia Studios, his wife, Joan Harvey, who was married to Larry Harvey. And after Larry passed away, I saw a lot of Joan, and we were very close, and I almost married her, but I just knew that wouldn't be right.
But other actors did do that.
Rock Hudson did that.
I can't speak for other actors. You know, their lives are their lives, and some people do things because for their career it's correct or this or that, but you have to be truthful to yourself.
You mentioned Rock Hudson. He, of course, died of AIDS. How big a scare was it when you were acting in Hollywood, Tab? How big a scare was AIDS, and how afraid were you?
Well, that was quite a bit later. I felt terrible for all these things that were going on, not just in Hollywood, but all around the country and around the world. I mean, it's terrible.
Did you lose a lot of friends?
I did lose a few friends, yes. I lost Rock, who was a very good friend, lived right up the street from me, and a couple of other people.
I asked Tab about this because Rock and Tab were they had very similar stories, you know, and they both have the same agent, Henry Wilson, and who was the man who discovered them and named them. But they never talked about this area at all. It was, but it was known. Is that right, Tab? I mean, you never really talked with Rock about,
well,
about
you,
this.
Known is one thing, and rumor you heard, you know, is another way of putting it. People would talk about other people and say, well, this or that, but, you know, I never confronted anything that was said about me because it was nobody's business.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Schwarz and Tab Hunter about their new movie. It's called Tab Hunter Confidential. And Tab, you were a matinee idol in the 50s and the 60s, and then along come the late 60s, early 70s, and there's a different look for stars. It's sort of an anti-establishment look. And I was wondering if you ever felt pressure to become more like Marlon Brando or James Dean.
No. Jimmy was Jimmy. Brando was Brando. I mean, people are themselves. They should be themselves. That's what it's all about.
But Tab took a lot of chances. You know, when the mainstream Hollywood stardom started to fade away, he did all kinds of different things. Like he did a movie called Sweet Kill, which was a low-budget horror movie where he played a psycho killer. And if you look at that movie, it is as far away from the squeaky clean image as you could possibly get. And it's a great movie. It was directed by Curtis Hanson, who did L.A. Confidential. It was his first movie as a director. And it was a real stretch for Tab. And if you can track that movie down, it's quite shocking, actually, to see Tab do the things that he does in that movie.
So when did you fall out of favor and why with the studio system?
Well, that's Hollywood. You know, you've been a good old wagon, but you done broke down. That's very Hollywood. And when I couldn't get arrested here, I went to Europe and did films in Europe. And then I was one of the pioneers of dinner theater. But this isn't just about my working career. This documentary is basically the journey. And we all are on a journey.
So when John Waters first approached you to be in Polyester, I mean, what did you think that this would do for your career?
I didn't think about what it would do for my career. I just thought, you know, I've got nothing to lose, everything to gain, and it's a fun script. And then John said, well, how would you feel about kissing a 250-pound transvestite? And I said, well, I'm sure I've kissed a hell of a lot worse. And, you know, Divine was one of my favorite leading ladies, along with Sophia Loren, Natalie Wood, Lana Turner, Geraldine Page. I mean, my gosh, he was really fun to work with, really good.
So, but you come across in this movie and in this interview as a very upbeat, optimistic, the glasses overflowing kind of person. But were there ever moments when you felt really dejected and, you know, depressed by being forced to be a person that you really weren't?
I had some very, very difficult times. And, you know, the glass, you got to look at it as half full as opposed to half empty. Too often people are negative, and that really bothers me. I'm a firm believer that under the pile of crap, there's got to be a pony.
That's a new one, Tab. I haven't heard you say that, and I've heard you say a lot of things.
So when you were saying that there were dark times, that was because after the studio cut you loose?
They didn't
or
cut
you left.
Me loose. I bought my contract out.
Yeah.
Because I wanted my freedom, because they didn't know what to do. My best work was on loan out to other studios where the studio would make a fortune and they'd give me my weekly salary. Or live television, those were great, great days. The days of Playhouse 90, Studio One, and all those terrific shows, Climax, what have you. Or the variety shows that you go on. Those were exciting times. But the studios were dying because television was coming in a big way. Studio contracts were over. They had to rid themselves of all the theaters they had around the country. And they didn't know which way to go. And then, of course, the influx of all the films from Europe where people wanted real people in real situations made a major impact on the la-di-da type stuff that was the majority of the la-di-da stuff that was coming out of Hollywood.
So now, I mean, it's a different era now in Hollywood, but do you
see
a lot different? What do you think in terms of leading men? Do you think that they're more free now to come out and to still
men
work
and
in
women,
Hollywood?
I think it's the same for men and women today. I don't think that you can be gay and be a leading man or a leading woman. I think you can be a character, you know, character actor or actress. But no, I think it's probably still the same today as it was then in many respects.
And Tab, when did you feel comfortable to be public about your sexuality?
I never really did feel comfortable about it. But I did mention it because when Alan told me that someone else was going to be doing a book. And he said, I think you should do a book. I thought, oh my gosh, I could never do that. And I thought, no, get it from the horse's mouth and not from some horse's ass after I'm dead and gone. Because people always put a spin on your life, and I don't want that. Look, what have I got to hide? This is my life. You like it or you don't like it. I'm, you know, accept it or don't accept it. That's your choice. God gave us a wonderful thing called free will. Use it.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
That's Tab Hunter and Jeffrey Schwarz with their new documentary, Tab Hunter Confidential, which you can see tomorrow night at Outfest at the Directors Guild Theater on Sunset. And it also happens to be Tab Hunter's 84th birthday. So it'll be a big party for him then as well.
Jeffrey, see you there. Saturday.
See you then with bells on.
Oh gosh.
Also wearing her bells, Jolie Myers in the house.
I literally call this sweatshirt that I'm wearing my I give up sweatshirt. So if that's bells, then
no
yes.
One can see.
Okay, so we talked about NIMBYs on the show today, the Hollywood genus this time. These are the folks that live in Beechwood Canyon. They don't want tourists up there, but they also want to market their homes on Airbnb using the Hollywood sign. Our listeners express something I like to call Nimbenfreude. David Tabor on Facebook feels no sympathy for the restaurant or the residents under the Hollywood sign. He says that they knew the sign existed when they moved there. What did they think was going to happen? And tourists inject millions of dollars in the area every year. Instead of trying to block them, residents should be out welcoming them with lemonade and cookies.
Okay, that sounds good at lunchtime. Thank you, Jolie Myers.
No problem.
And if you want to weigh in on that, our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney to the point up next at 1 o'clock. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.